Well, good evening, brothers and sisters. It looks like it's a little cool in here, just by the number of people that are sort of all bundled up. But anyway, I think we get into this, we'll get warmed up a little. At least the overhead will add a little heat. Now, this is unfortunate for the tapes, because the diagram is pretty important in this, and trying to describe that on audio tape, well, I'm not sure I could do that very easily. But the first point we'd like to make tonight is an aspect of conscience that is quite critical to make it work. And I'd like to illustrate that by just going to your diagram and illustrating the problems that we would have at some of these valves. For instance, we were trying to illustrate this, that this status quo valve must probably in our life almost always remain closed. If in fact we're doing something that's rather routine and we're not thinking about necessarily anything and there's no one else bothering us, it could very well be that it's open and life's experiences are just going on and there isn't really any active conscience at all. But our ability to close that valve is the critical one. Running that valve open, because we just don't want to think about it. It's something that's happening, and I've heard my kids say that sometimes, and it makes me shudder when they just don't want you to talk about their problem. Just, you know, leave me alone kind of thing, and you know that that's not the way to handle this. You can't resolve this thing by just shutting down. You've got to keep that valve closed and force yourselves to think about it. And if you force yourself to think about it, then it could just change. In other words, the pressure of life could just cause your life's experiences to go out this valve, which is just something that would happen due to purely human terms. It may be a few human resources, and this valve here would have to be opened. And if there were some resources there, like, you know, that's not necessarily true. If there's nothing there, then it can't help opening that valve. But we never normally, in our experience, want this one closed. We'll keep that one open for the sake of what it might help us with. And then this has to be developed. As you might guess, with a child, initially, there isn't any spiritual valve. There is nothing up there in that upper conscience to work. It takes time for the ability of a child to even appreciate spiritual things. But we need to make sure that doesn't just stay closed. In other words, take life's experiences and let them go up into the higher court, allowing more information and more time to be involved. And when they get into the higher court, we must make sure this is closed, because if that one is left open, then it's just a matter of us thinking that because we took it to a member of the ecclesia, or we talked about it at that level, or we opened our Bible and read something, that necessarily then that's done. And we go on and do what we want anyway. That's self-deception. So that's important, to be able to close that valve. And it's very important to be able to open this one. Because without spiritual resources on a decision that's critical, you can't expect we could really do any better than the lower court, because we're not allowing any spiritual resources to act upon the decision. So we need to be able to open that valve, and we should have this stacked. Like, if the spiritual resources there, should be there. If not immediately there, then we should know how to access them and be prepared to wait some time. So all the way through this, these valves are requiring discipline. And discipline isn't easy to come by. And I think in our life, it's getting harder to come by. I'd like to just deal with a subject matter of discipline from the Old Testament to illustrate. You don't see much of this anymore, if any of it anymore. You turn to Joshua chapter 9. Now, this is the account of the unfortunate situation that Joshua found himself in when a bunch of people showed up on his doorstep claiming that they had come from a far country and they wanted to make a peace agreement with him, and Joshua, it appears, may have talked this over with the people, but certainly didn't consult God and just looked at the human appearance of what he could see from these people and believed their story. When he believed their story, then they swore unto them that they would not harm them. And it says in verse 15, Joshua made peace with them, made a league with them to let them live, and the princes of the congregation swear unto them. Now try to put yourself in this situation, because I mean, these situations do happen in life today where you've sat down and made an agreement with a person that something was going to happen and you agreed, they agreed, and however documents are signed and sealed, it's done. And then the very next day you find that these people were not able to carry out their part, knew that they weren't, they had totally faked their part. How would you feel? Would you try to get out of it? Would you think, for instance, that that was sufficient grounds to go to a court and appeal to the court that this person, knowing that they couldn't keep their part of the agreement, went into the agreement and therefore it should be declared null and void? They didn't do that. They didn't do that. Because it says when they found out that they were neighbors in verse 16 and they dwelt among them, and verse 18, that the whole congregation murmured against the princes for doing this. The princes said unto the congregation, we have sworn unto them by Yahweh, God of Israel, now therefore we may not touch them. Now that's self-discipline. That is being constrained by an agreement that you went into, that you signed, even though it turned out ill. I am amazed, and it may very well be that you are as well, of the number of young people who will stand up in front of the whole ecclesia and all the friends they have invited and declare wonderful vows to each other of how they will love each other, they will serve each other, they will do those things which well beyond what the law requires to be said in a marriage ceremony. Bind themselves by it in front of everybody there and God himself. And then when things don't go well, they separate. Now, if you don't know of any of those things ever happening in South Africa, then I can only say it happens in Canada. It happens in the United States. And it's not right. Like, people don't seem to know what it means to keep your word. Even if it's ill, it works out wrong for you. The facts are that what these people here did for us is showed us the standard of what happens when you swear to God by an oath. That they told the congregation, we have sworn unto Yahweh, now therefore we may not touch them. And of course they were able to deal with them, as God had said, for people that were far off, they could be drawers of water and hewers of wood for them, but they were not allowed to destroy them. That, to my mind, is worth thinking about. Do we keep our word? Are we a person that's so dependable that when we say to a person, we'll meet you tomorrow night, Lord willing, at such and such a time and such a place, we're there waiting? Or when the other person gets there, we wonder whether that person isn't going to show up, is late or whatever. Like, there's some people constantly late. And you wonder, it almost seems like they set their watch, you know, 20 minutes behind time and then... Well, 20 minutes ahead of time, or whatever they do, they mess it up. Regularly. Almost you can depend at a certain time in the meeting's going, they will appear. Now, that is just not the kind of discipline that we need in our present day, and certainly it won't carry us through the conscience factors that we see here of knowing that something's not going well with us, and then refusing to actually do the manipulation that conscience requires so that out of all this, we might get this quality agape. have a look at Psalm 15. Doesn't this set the standard? And isn't it a wonderful thing sometimes when we have the presence of mind and we have the dedication that we do this, that we feel comforted by this is what we were supposed to do. That's all we're just what we're supposed to do. It's nothing extra. But Psalm 15, verse 1, Yahweh, who shall abide in thy tabernacle? Who shall dwell in thy holy hill? He that walketh uprightly and worketh righteousness and speaks the truth in his heart. He that backbiteth not with his tongue, nor doeth evil to his neighbor, nor taketh up a reproach against his neighbor, in whose eyes a vile person is condemned, but he honoreth them that fear Yahweh. He that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not. He that putteth not out his money to usury, nor taketh reward against the innocent. He that doeth these things shall never be moved. And that one little section in there is what I was focusing on. He that swears to his own hurt and changes not. That's the integrity God expects us to have in life. And it seems to me that conscience is a joke if there isn't that integrity. Like if every time we get into a situation, we don't have the discipline in our bodies to do what the scriptures tell us to do, then this is certainly not going to work, because this is focused and built upon discipline, where you just turn off that valve. You will not allow the status quo to continue because you got a red light in your mind. You're not going to condemn yourself by what you allow. That's what Paul says in Romans. Blessed is the man who condemns not himself in that which he alloweth. So we have got to be people that are very strong-willed. Now you see this in kids sometimes, and you think, how are we ever going to deal with this one? You see this little kid with a very strong will. Well, I'll tell you, if you can focus it right, it could be a tremendous asset for the child. If you can just get them turned around, so that the person, having determined and having said and having gone down a road, will not turn back. We know that's true of the truth, but you say, why is it today that marriages are just seem to be breaking up and people walking away from things which were vows said in our presence and in the presence of God? We're working one, or at least I'm working on one privately back in our ecclesia now. It breaks my heart. I was there at the wedding. I heard them say the wonderful things they said. And now they're separate by thousands of miles and happy. That's not right. There's something happened in our personal discipline that's broke down there. I mean, everyone can give you excuses. I've listened to him. I've listened to her. But neither of them are right. Because if they were right, they ought to have read these kinds of things and thought their vow was more important than their personal well-being in front of the other. Neither of them are getting beaten up. Neither of them are really getting hurt. They just don't like each other. And it's really sad. But I think it's maybe more pervasive than less in our world today. We go to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. This is the one we normally turn to for thinking about discipline. And, you know, brothers and sisters, really all these things are is just bringing us all into remembrance of things we've studied and we've learned before, focusing on certain aspects so that we can think it through again and be stronger in our resolve to be right before our God. So 1 Corinthians chapter 9, where the Apostle Paul says in verse 24, know you not that they which run in a race run all, but one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain. Now I think it's wonderful if children can get into some competition somewhere in their life. Now I know not everybody agrees with this, but I think it is a good idea. Not that you want them to go to some, you know, great heights in competitive sport, but to feel the pain in your side to be first. To know the training you have to go through, the discipline of your life to reach to heights of excellence. And apart from that, you sort of wonder, people are just not prepared to accept the truth. So run that you may obtain. He's not talking about running a race, but if you've never run a race, if you've never been in competition, you can't empathize with what he's saying. Every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things, self-controlled in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly so fight I, not as one that beateth the air, but I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that at any means, by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. And that's because of our nature. It's never beaten till it's dead. So a person could have done wonderful, wonderful things in their life for the first 50 years and the last 10 years give up and hence become a castaway. We can't never give up. Our determination to have determination and discipline must never, ever reduce. Now there's another thing that I think is important in conscience, because it relates to how we are in preparation for the kingdom age. You get this out of Proverbs 31, and then we'll see a couple echoes of it. Proverbs 31, and it's not necessarily to do with women. As most of you would know, Proverbs 31, as I do, is the place where you go to find the virtuous woman. But it's before the virtuous woman. And it says in verse 3, give not thy strength unto women, nor thy ways to that which destroyeth kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It's not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes strong drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the judgment of any of the afflicted. Now, we can't limit that to drink, because what they really mean is intoxication. And you can be intoxicated, or your mind can be taken off what's important by a number of things that are not necessarily drugs, chemicals. Where we can be intoxicated by a television program where you won't answer the phone, you won't go to the door, you won't do the readings, you won't do anything, because that's the time the program comes on and your life is disciplined by those things. I know, I've been there. I was raised with television. I know all about it, and we've rejected it. Dorothy and I in our life, we've never had it since we were married and never missed it. The facts are that these things intoxicate us. How can we work out a conscience when our conscience is supposed to be so sensitive that it's always there, is a little blinking light telling us it's always there, it's always active, when in fact it just shuts off for periods of intoxication? In other words, I turn my conscience on when the program is over. That's not the way it's to be. Because that is one of the prime times when we ought to have a conscience. That if we can allow ourselves to be entertained with that kind of stuff which is out there in the world today, then obviously our conscience isn't developed. That plug in the middle has never opened yet to go to spiritual values. I often wonder, I do a lot of driving, and I used to have a radio on all the time. My radio conked out and I never fixed it, so I don't have the problem anymore. But the radio was a real problem for me. Because being that the radio was there, and it wasn't a tape player, and it's just a radio, it seemed to me that it was something just to get along with the boredom, you know, to deal with the boredom of driving. You turn the radio on just for company. But I tell you, I found it so terribly annoying that you'd have a thought that maybe was worthy entertaining, and then the radio would come on and destroy your whole line of action. Or you thought of something that was really good and helpful, and before you got a chance to even jot it down somewhere, it was destroyed by the radio. And it occurred to me to think that if our angel is with us when we're driving, and that radio is offensive to the angel, isn't it inconsistent? Like, isn't it a matter of conscience that if this thing that we're listening to, this music, the lyrics of it, is really the bottom line. would be offensive to the angel, then it's inconsistent to pray to God that the angel would be with us when we're traveling. Well, all the time we're traveling, we have something in our car that's playing that would offend the angel, even if it doesn't offend us. And there's the lyrics of almost all of the popular music of the day are offensive to the ideas of the scripture. So we've got to be people that live these things and make these things happen in our life. Don't allow ourselves to go through periods of intoxication where we just lapse into shutting off our conscience so we can do something else. And then when we get there, turn on the conscience. You can't do that with conscience. It's got to be there all the time. Always sensitive to what we're thinking, what we're listening to, what we're doing, and other people that are around us. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 16. Verse 19, and the same thing, brothers and sisters. The Bible is wonderful in the sense that it can round out any subject area to prepare people to live properly. At verse 19, it says, "Thou shalt not wrest judgment. Thou shalt not respect persons, neither take a gift. For a gift doth blind the eyes of the wise and pervert the words of the righteous." Now, what would you do if you were in my position? And I'm going to ask you this a number of times during these sessions. I have this student, and this student is probably 35 years old, married, had a lot of difficulty in my course. He's in a 3-year program, and he failed it the first year. He shows up to work on my course in the second year and gives up very quickly, so essentially he fails it again. It comes to the third year, and he's passed everything else but my course, first year course. So he's taking this course with me, and he's not doing very well. But towards the end of the semester, he comes to my door with a bottle of wine, and he says, "I'm giving this to all my faculty before the exam." Would that prick your conscience a little? Would you feel that you're maybe getting paid to pass them? Now, this is life. And I must say, that happened so quickly to me, I was just astounded by the fact that a student would do that. I found out from other faculty, he does it to all the teachers. So it may have been that he wasn't really trying to bribe me, but at the time, I was just astounded that a student would do that, come to the door with a bottle of wine and congratulate me having a good year and helping him, all that, and he hadn't passed yet, and it wasn't very good. He finally did pass, but I didn't feel comfortable with that. That really bothered my conscience. If that ever happened again, I would act differently. And quite often, that's the way life is. Like you go through an experience and you're not sure. It happened so quickly, you just weren't sure what to do. So you did something. And then after, the wine's still under my desk. I didn't touch the stuff. And that's 2 years ago. So I don't know whether it's getting better or worse or whatever. I don't think I'll ever touch that bottle. But anyway, the fact is, he gave it to me, I took it, and then I started thinking. And I thought, boy, that wasn't the right thing to do. And I talked to the other faculty about it, but they had taken it as well, and this chap had done it. And it's just one of those experiences that I came back to this verse in my mind: "Thou shalt not wrest judgment, shall not respect persons, neither take a gift, for a gift blinds the eyes of the wise, perverts the words of the righteous." Now I tell you, that wine did not change my mark. I was determined, after having thought about this, that in no sense at all would I give that student a break. If he didn't pass, he didn't pass. That would be the way I'd do it. Because, I mean, how else could you do it? Otherwise, once you're bought off once, it must be much easier the second time to be bought off. Now, I should well imagine you brethren and sisters know this. Hey, this is not just me. Hey, this is life. People have probably come to you with something similar as a proposition to sort of buy off, to cover up something, to let them do something others don't get the right to do. I find that you've got to have your conscience on all the time to handle situations like this, and the more you can put into your spiritual resources, if that ever happens again, on with that valve, and this is the action. That's the way I would do it the next time. So that verse has got to help. And just one other, just over the page in Deuteronomy 17. I often wonder if kings did this. Like, it's written so obvious in the record, and people had access to the book of Deuteronomy. Did the kings, like King Solomon seems to have failed in almost all of these, but did the kings know this? Verse 16, he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to the end that they should multiply horses. For as much as Yahweh has said unto you, you shall henceforth return no more that way. Neither shall he multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away. Neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. Like Solomon, all three of those he did. Yet he was a wise man. But he didn't end so well. Now this is the one I want to focus on. It shall be when he sits upon the throne of his kingdom that he shall write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priests and the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear Yahweh his God, to keep all the words of this law and these statutes to do them, that his heart be not lifted up above his brethren, and that he turn not aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, to the end that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. Now, I haven't written out my copy yet. Has anybody? Because we all hope to be kings. It would seem to me, therefore, that not that I believe we should all start writing tonight, you know, and get our copy made, but the facts are that God saw that was the only way to govern. For a person who's governing, you've got to have the Word of God in your mind every day of your life. All the days of his life he shall read therein after making the copy. There is no other way that a king can reign faithfully before God without that arrangement. So the spiritual resources, see, should not be empty when you come and open that valve. If that's the case, we haven't been living right. If we come to a time where we have to make a decision, a conscience, and we're looking for some help, and we open the valve and just can't think of a verse, we can't think of anything to help us, and if we have to make it quick, it could very well be the wrong decision. So there's a number of things about this spiritual resources tank that we need to think about. Now let's just take a moment and look at this diagram. In fact, we'll put another one on here just to get rid of those. What I'd like to consider is that here is a person thinking of being baptized. Now, if you turn to 1 Peter chapter 3, it says something about conscience and baptism. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 21. The like figure whereunto even baptism doth also now save us, not the putting away of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience toward God by the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So baptism is a measure of conscience. It's done out of conscience. Now, how do you think the valves should be arranged in that diagram for a person preparing for baptism? Which is the obvious one we gotta do something with? Anyone just tell me? Yeah. You couldn't possibly be baptized just letting the events of life go by without ever doing anything about them. You'd have to make sure that you're prepared to stop and think. Number two. Okay, but as long as this one is in that position, it's open. If that valve's open, you never get enough pressure to go to spiritual valves, spiritual heights. So we'd have to close this one. In other words, we're not, baptism is not a result of our lower court. It's not a result of human values. You wouldn't get baptism on that basis. That's why children aren't baptized, because children can never get the spiritual values that they need to be baptized until they're old enough to mature spiritually. The world didn't see it that way. They wanted children baptized, so they must have closed a few of these valves and allowed the kids to be baptized, or they thought they were baptized. But the scriptures tell us that you must have this valve open. If it's a matter of conscience, then the person being baptized must make the decision to be baptized, not somebody else. Well, that's one of the first things parents have to come to grips with. And there's some difficult situations in life. Like, it's not easy. If a child is very sick, then, you know, people really start to rethink these things. But baptism is a matter of conscience. So the child is not baptized for somebody else or for any other reason, that it's a personal choice. I mean, you stand before a court of law and you're trying to tell them why you will not go out to fight in a battle to defend your country that you were living off, so to speak. Well, because you're a citizen of another country. Well, how did you become a citizen of another country? Well, I made the conscious decision to be baptized. And the conscious decision of that is an adult decision. So I might have been born into a country, but the decision I made when I was old enough with having a conscience was to declare myself the citizen of another country, of which the Bible tells me that we ought to obey God rather than men. So I have a higher allegiance. My allegiance is to the country for which I'm a citizen of as an adult. You couldn't do that if you're a child. You're baptized as a child. There'd be no way that you could argue that way. People would laugh at you. You made a decision when you were so many days old that you were going to be the citizen of another country. So that spiritual valve has to be open, because out of conscience is done by people who are thinking at that level. What next? If we leave it like it is, it's self-deception. You'd have to close that valve. In other words, you'd have to make sure that you were not doing this for another reason. If you're getting baptized because you're going to marry that person over there, that is wrong. It is not a decision of conscience. That's deception, self-deception. You do that. If you're being baptized because you want to be in favor with the boss, and the boss is a Christadelphian, so you're going to make it out that you're sincere and you're going to play along, that's self-deception. You're not being baptized for the right reasons. The only way you can be baptized and produce agape is because you have had this valve open and enough spiritual resources in here to properly understand it, so that you do it with good conscience. Your conscience is commending the action to be baptized. And if, of course, we're baptized, if anybody would be baptized with a conscience that's condemning, in other words, we're saying you're not consistent, you're doing this not for the right reason, then, of course, it is self-deception. So you can reason through this, I think, to help yourself focus on where you need help, where you have to apply discipline, where you might expect that people could have problems, and how you can help them, so that when you sit down to interview a candidate for baptism, you want to just make sure that they're not being deceived about this. They really understand what they're doing, and they're doing it for the right reasons. That would be working through conscience. Now, what we want to deal with, and I'm certainly not going to deal with this exhaustively, but we want to get a taste for this, is consciences in collision. And I want to start with Acts 15, just to give you an idea what we mean by consciences in collision. Now, this is one of a very few events in Scripture where it appears that two men, equally righteous before God, disagreed on what to do. So in verse 36 for connection, some days after, Paul said to Barnabas, "Let's go again and visit our brethren in every city where we have preached the word of the Lord and see how they do." And Barnabas determined to take with them John, whose surname was Mark. But Paul thought not good to take him with them, who departed from them from Pamphylia and went not with them to the work. And the contention was so sharp between them that they departed asunder, one from the other. So Barnabas took Mark, sailed to Cyprus, and Paul chose Silas and departed, being recommended by the brethren unto the grace of God. And he went through Syria and Cilicia, confirming the ecclesias. Now, if all of our problems were resolved that way, you could say we could benefit by it, because instead of two people going out, we now have four people going out preaching. So, I mean, it had a good outcome. But it illustrates that you might expect that people with the best interests of their Lord and service of the truth in mind could disagree so sharp that they can't work together. So one goes one way and one goes another. Not that they were out of fellowship or anything like that, but they had decided that they would part company so that each of them could go and do what they had in mind. And the truth benefited. So it's a little example, but it's not really good, because it's not the kind we normally deal with. They're a lot messier than that. Now, this kind of contention happened between Abraham and Lot, and we know how Abraham handled it. It happened to a sense between Ruth and Naomi, where Naomi was seemingly just wanting Ruth to depart like her other daughter-in-law, but Ruth was very persistent that she was going to continue with Naomi to an outcome that Naomi must not have had any mind or any thought of at the time. So it had a happy outcome. You have Moses and Aaron and Miriam in strife, where they, or Miriam and Moses, or Aaron rather, were challenging Moses' leadership. And it didn't end too well for Miriam in that one. So there's a number of cases where there was, if you might say, contention in a family matter that wasn't too serious, although I don't think you could say with Moses and Aaron and Miriam it was not too serious. If you go to Matthew chapter 10, here's where the contention gets to hostility. In other words, it rises to the point where somebody gets hurt. And the Lord Jesus Christ understood this, and he knew it would happen. He said in verse 34, "Think not I am come to send peace on earth. I come not to send peace, but a sword. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's foes shall be they of his own household. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. He that taketh not his cross and followeth after me is not worthy of me. He that findeth his life shall lose it. He that loseth his life for my sake shall find it." Now you sort of think of how you would ever work through that diagram with some of those things where you have father against son and mother against daughter-in-law and things like that, where, you know, how would your conscience work if in fact you were the person who was the Christian and the other person who was a member you loved of your family was now set dead against you? And it just occurs all the time in our ecclesias, especially now with the seminars where people are coming out from these other faiths, coming and attracted to the scriptures, and then find that they got a real big price tag to pay. They've either got to cut every link they have with their family to become into the truth, or forget the truth and stay with the family. And there's a number of people in our ecclesia have had to do that. They have had constant conflict with their parents and their brothers and sisters because they have left the truth. They have left their family to come into the truth. So what's happened, what the Lord says here is really an important venture. Now, it must be, they had their spiritual valve open because they could not make those decisions at the human level. If it was at the human level, they would never have left mom and dad. But because they allowed their conscience to be motivated by spiritual resources like those verses, and thinking it very, very carefully, self-deception not likely being open in that case, because there was too much at stake, they were prepared to produce agape. The thing they want to make sure is that valve does not allow the whole system to drain down, or that they never run out of spiritual resources, because that's a fight for life, always making that. There is the odd case where after so many years, mom and dad took another view of it, sometimes because of grandchildren, or sometimes because of circumstances for which they likewise became baptized. But in a number of cases, it's been a battle to the day of their death. Now, this problem in the ecclesia is one that we really need to talk about a little. Split twice. Brethren were thinking of getting away from each other. We couldn't stand each other because of certain things that happened. One was a marriage and divorce situation, and another was a doctrinal point that came up. And I must say, the thoughts that went through my mind were many, and as any of you have been through that, you know those are the nights that you don't sleep very well, if you sleep at all. I don't think there's anything that makes you feel worse than ecclesial troubles. I don't think there's anything that can take more of a toll on your health and on your energy than ecclesial problems. Where you come to the ecclesia, you expect a refuge. You expect to find brothers and sisters, people that will shake your hand with a real good solid handshake. We're glad to see you. But if you come to brothers and sisters that you've had a battle with over something, and they're in one corner, and you just go down to your seat and sit in another corner, that is a horrible experience. Now, there's ways to deal with this. And I must say that, and I wouldn't mind, you know, if this goes on the audio tape at all. Not at all. The two brethren came to our rescue in Shelburne, Brother Harry Tennant and Michael Ashton. And you would know those brethren, right? Because we had the wisdom, even in all the clutter we had going on in the ecclesia, to say, we need help. How many times people get into trouble and they won't admit they need help? And the only time that they ever even, you know, extend to get help is when it's too late. I have tried to help in several ecclesial problems in the United States and Canada where someone's invited me to come, but they were already divided. And it's almost impossible to put things together. You take a piece of wood that is broken apart and you try to put that together so you can't see the edges, and you can't do it. People have got to ask for help before you split apart and recognize that if we are so set in our conscience that this is the way, this is the truth, and we don't think the other brethren and sisters have got it, and of course they're in their position, no, you haven't got the truth, we've got it. But isn't there another doctrine involved? Like, isn't the doctrine of unity? Isn't there another doctrine that blessed are the peacemakers? Like, where does all this go when we're in the middle of a conflict? These are the things that tell us that when we get to a level of where there seems to be hostility in a meeting, we try to adjourn the meeting with no decision. Like, let's just go home. And when we have cooler minds, we'll come back and we'll talk about it again. And that is one of the things which probably would just be human resources, human wisdom, that has helped through some of the problems. It's just delay the decision. You do not have to make it tonight. When you see a brother or a sister out of control, don't push it. You know, you just retire from the scene and feel embarrassed for the person. Without trying to make them feel worse or look worse, try to retract from the situation to save the person. We're not in the position to destroy people. We're wanting to save people. And if we can save people sometimes who are a little different in us in the truth, that's good reasoning. You happen to be a hand. You're saving a foot. You need feet if you're a hand. and it works vice versa. The differences in an ecclesia are the strengths of an ecclesia sometimes. Now, I'm not talking about false doctrine. If that's what you're thinking immediately, then don't think that way. Because that sometimes is where it gets pushed to. But many times it starts on a much lower level, and it's little things. And you know that if the little things don't get solved, they'll get pushed and pushed until finally you get a big thing to solve. And since you're already divided, people just naturally gravitate to the poles. And now you have something that you can divide over. We have to be very, very careful that, you know, just apply a little human wisdom to some of these things. Now, the Lord was very merciful to us because Matthew 18, I don't want to look these things up because I tend to think that most of you know this. And if you don't, I'll give you my verses. They're all written down here. But Matthew 18 gives us the criteria that when you have a trouble with somebody, you go to them. Go to them. Like, take the time, visit them, sit down with them and try to work it out. And probably most of the situations can be worked out right there. But people don't do that. The first thing they do is go and tell somebody else. And then when the other person finds out somebody else knows, it's a conflict that can't be decided so simply. People haven't followed, even if they're right sometimes, have not followed the way the Lord set how we should resolve these disputes. So Matthew 18 is the very first thing. But you must know, brothers and sisters, in our family life, how that proverb that says a soft answer turns away wrath really does. How a person can be very angry, but you could just turn them around sometimes, not everybody, but sometimes with just a soft answer. Like, it's worth a try to take the time to just swallow your pride or whatever it is and talk to the person and talk softly to the person. It's important that if you go to that hymn we sung from Psalm 133 and just note what it says there. Behold how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. Does that mean anything to us? Is it just a hymn we sing, or is it something that pervades our meetings? So that if we come to a point where we know we're likely going to have differences, we really try to stress unity. We really try to stress we've got to see this together. It's like the precious ointment upon the head that ran down upon the beard, even Aaron's beard that went down to the skirts of his garments, as the dew of Hermon, as the dew that descended upon the mountains of Zion. So you get all these garments that are made for the high priest, and they've all been made separately, independently, and they all have their own place and their own glory. And then oil is poured over that just unites them on the body. That's the spirit of unity. What is it that will just unite us? They'll take all the differences, how we're made, and the things that we do, the functions we have, and just like oil poured over the high priest would just unite us. Well, I dare say the two brethren that came had enough wisdom. Either of them had enough, but it was important to have two. I've learned that. You don't ask one person to resolve something. You ask two people to resolve something like that. And they were able to bring us together. We thank our God. Years later, we are still thanking our God that we are one ecclesia, having gone through a situation that was almost, it would have been stupid for us to have divided in Shelburne. But you look around the world and you find, if it's called, be called stupid, it's the stupidity is found in a number of places around the world where you have an ecclesia in a city of 1 million people and there's not another ecclesia within miles of the place. And there's two little ecclesias with three or four brethren in each and they can't meet together. That's human nature. That's not stressing the unity of the body. That's not allowing our consciences to work like they ought to. That's putting me, the person, first before the truth. And that, brothers and sisters, is wrong. Now, I want to finish on a little lighter note. That's pretty heavy. We'll just finish on a little lighter note. In fact, I'm going to give you some homework. Now, this is where we live in a rough diagram, and the Chrysodeltian families around them.
This is Dorothy in my place here. This is my brother Bruce is here. This is just a neighbor. That's just a neighbor. This is the Wilsons. They're members of our ecclesia on the farm. Across them is a neighbor, but a rather important neighbor. This is the hall. Across them is the Christadelphian styles. I didn't draw this one, but my mother lives right here in another house. So there is about a kilometer between this road up here and this road here. So we're all around the same area, and there's 100 acres. They're all 100 acre plots. Now this is the dilemma. All these red lines represent fences. We're farmers. You got to have fences. You don't have fences, your cows water. We all have, pretty well all have cows. Where it's a cow raising country. So if, my brother has some sheep up here on this plot of land, but basically everybody else has cows. And there's a couple places where they don't have anything. So these little holes in the fence represent a gate. You've got to get into your farm, so there's a gate there. And quite often we don't have a gate. We are very different than South Africans in this sense. Dorothy and I could not lock our house. There is no lock on the door. We never lock our car. We leave our things all over the place. That's just the way we live in Southern Ontario. That is not a problem. There is the occasional time, but normally you do not have to worry about anybody thieving anything. Now, Mr. Bennett up here is an old man. He's about 70 years old. He has lived on this place all his life. This is a century farm. They pioneered this area on that farm, and the house is still there, and he's living in this house. But the house has holes in the roof. In other words, he has not looked after this house, so the roof is caving in, and he's living in an area where it's tarped in the house. He's been in this area, living like this, for years. He has, now this is, I'm telling you the story from about, 10 years ago? 5-10 years ago. Mr. Bennett is dead. Now, 5-10 years ago, when he was living in this house, he had 30 dogs on the premise. The dogs lived in the house with him, all the time, with him. He had a farm that was more like the county dump. He had machinery going back as far back as they made the stuff. Like, he had thrashing machines, so you can't even see these things anymore. But he had them on his farm somewhere. He had one, I don't know how many old tractors he had. And even the tractor he presently had, it was a crank job. And I tell you, you ought to see a man do that. He was an old man, 70 years old, and he could crank that tractor. He was a strong man. He used to have cattle on his farm, but he cried whenever he had to sell them. He got so bad at his old age, he couldn't sell his cows. He couldn't sell his horses. He couldn't manage the place, and he couldn't fix his fences. Well, that was a problem for all of us. This man that lived in a little corner here was the man who took the brunt of it, because with the holes I put in the fence, when his cows got that they ate everything on his property, they just moved to the next available property, which was usually his lawn. Now, having 30 cows move across your lawn leaves the garden, the lawn, the walkway, the fence, the door, the everything in the place in a little bit of a state of ruin. So there wasn't such a good relationship between these two people. But he didn't have a very big area, so the cows didn't stay long there. Our brother Wilson, Brother Graham Wilson, has, by mind, the patience of the Apostle Paul. Because the cows of Bennett's would come across into his place at night, at 2 or 3 in the morning, and would walk through his place, so he'd have to get up at 2 or 3 in the morning and chase these cows out, because Mr. Bennett was somewhere else. He'd have to do it. And not only that, when his cows came over, so did his dogs. Now, I want to tell you about these dogs. These weren't normal dogs. These dogs were just left so that they had inbred. and they were vicious, and everybody was afraid of them. Sister Wilson went out one night to find her dog, and she found a skeleton on the lawn. They'd ate it overnight. We very often, down at the hall, when it was dark in the fall time, would hear cows bellowing on Bennett's farm. And what they were bellowing for was they were being attacked by the dogs, because the dogs were hungry. If the cows had a calf, there were only a very few calves ever survived. Most of them got eaten by the dogs. There were cows going around with bits of an ear missing, a tail missing. The authorities were called into Mr. Bennett's place, and he held them off with a gun. He was arrested by the police and taken away, given psychiatric assessment, and said he was okay. He went back to the farm and got his gun. Everybody was afraid of Mr. Bennett because of the fact that he had one eye, and you weren't too sure which was the good one. And with 30 dogs and with a gun, and knowing he had held off the police at his place, you didn't venture far into that, knowing those dogs were hungry. So that's the kind of a neighbor that we had. When Mr. Bennett's cows got out, he would try to fix his fences and put them back in, but as soon as the cows got hungry again, they were out again. There was really nothing to do that he could do to hold or retain his cattle, and we all knew it, except from all of us volunteering to fix all those fences, which would have cost a lot of money. And even then, the cattle would have starved in there. It was a problem that nobody in the community really knew how to handle. Now, Brother Wilson only has one eye as well. It's really interesting that this is the only hill in the area, and both men on that hill had one eye. This was mighty interesting. Because Mr. Bennett didn't manage his horses properly, the horses would fight in the springtime. And the dominant stallion on the farm would chase away the other stallions. It would just literally chase them off the farm. So this is where the problem started.
Here we are down here, minding our own business.
Now one day, one of Mr. Bennett's stallions comes down and thinks that this might be a nice place to stay. Now, Dorothy was the one that had to face the brunt of this, because this horse had never been saddled, never had a rope on him, and he was absolutely wild, but chewed all over. You looked at his back and there was bite marks. He'd been beat up by the horses on that farm. He came down to our farm, and he came down in May. Now, May is a difficult month for us, because if it was May, it would have been April or May. It was early spring. The ground was soft from the snow melting, so if a horse or any large animal goes on your lawn or in your fields, they go down in the mud about 6 to 8 inches. So a horse walking around just put marks in your lawn all over the place, and they're not easy to get out when they're that deep. So he's walking around my lawn, and Dorothy goes out to put her washing out, and the horse is lonely. He comes over to see how Dorothy is. And I'm not too sure Dorothy appreciated that, but you ask her, she'll tell you. So we're thinking, well, what should we do to this horse? Well, how are we going to deal with this horse? I don't like horses. I never have. If anybody here is a horse lover, you may leave. When I was a boy about so big, my dad decided that he would board horses on the farm. And he got a couple very high-spirited stallions from the racetrack who had injuries, and he kept them in the barn. And I thought they were the most ugly, vicious animals I'd ever had to look after. It was my brother Ron and my job to go down and feed these animals. And they, when you pass by them, they'd reach out with their teeth, they'd bite you. And I thought, you know, thanks for having the horse here, you know. And my dad was a butcher, and he knew how to handle these creatures. And one morning, when I went down the barn, I found the horses got out, and they were fighting in the barn. They were kicking and fighting. I wasn't going to walk in there. So I went up to the house, and I was terrified, really. I told my dad, so he went in there with a hockey stick. He had both of those horses back where they ought to be in just a short time. I don't know how many horses my dad had killed in his life at the slaughterhouse, but it was thousands. So he could handle it. But anyway, I couldn't figure out what we're going to do with this horse. It occurred to me, I get Mr. Bennett down. Well, now this is how Mr. Bennett would have done. And I can tell you this from first-hand experience. You see this little place here? That's quicksand. You know what quicksand is? There's not much of a bottom there. You get into that stuff and you just go down, a horse or a cow or anything, just disappear in there. Well, one day, my dad, driving along the road here, noticed that Bennett's cows were all out in the road. And one of his cows was in the quicksand, and all you could see was the head. So he went up to Mr. Bennett's place and told him that his cows were in trouble down there. So Mr. Bennett has a big red steak truck, dual wheels on the back, huge thing. So he came down, he had about 12 dogs in the truck, and a great big rope. He comes down, backs up to where the cow was, lassoes the cow, she has really vicious horns. He lassoes this cow, ties her to the truck, jumps in the truck, and away he goes. Now, he didn't go away slowly. He just went away. I don't know whether he expected this cow's neck would go like this or what, but anyway, the cow came out, stretched out as much as it could on the road, and my dad thought the thing was dead because, I mean, he never saw a cow's neck get elongated so much and just get right out of the ditch. So anyway, out of that experience, it was really quite interesting what happened there, because my dad went up to take the rope off this cow because he thought if it didn't die from being pulled out, it would have died from strangulation, because it was one of those knots that just tightened up so the cow couldn't breathe. So he's there getting the knot off. And while my dad was the same age, he was 70 at the time too. While he's getting the knot off, this cow jumps up on its feet and charges my dad with these big horns. So my dad was terrified at this prospect. So Mr. Bennett noticed this, and he just said to the dogs, "Get her." Those 12 dogs had that cow back and out of there in just a few seconds. Like, these dogs responded to whatever he said. He could command those dogs to do whatever. That was another thing that was a little bit scary about him, because if you ever told the dogs to eat you, I'm sure they would have. You know? So I thought about this. I thought, well, if I got Mr. Bennett down, I know what's going to happen. Here comes the truck. Here comes the rope. And this is going to be interesting, because I even haven't got this horse corralled. Now, this went on for a couple days. And Dave Stiles, Brother Stiles up here, he was looking after Ron's children. This was it was sometime after my brother Ron died, and he was looking after the children with Mary. And one of these children said that she had actually fed this horse some oats by just going up and with a pail of oats leaning over the fence. So she said, "I could probably get a halter on him." So she came down with a pail of oats. But the horse was quite smart. He would eat the oats, but as soon as she went with a halter, he was gone out of there. And we tried this several times, and there was just no way we could capture this horse. He wasn't going back. He seemed to like our place more and more, and I was getting a little bit fed up with him, and I'm sure Dorothy was too. So I thought, I'll just watch this horse, and I'll see if there's some way to deal with this. So I looked out one night when I came home, and I noticed that he was looking in our barn. I thought, I bet you he's lonely. Like, he was raised on a farm with cattle. I have cattle, but my cattle were all pregnant cows. I think they were, like, calving would be May, June for us. So I thought, well, I'll let him in. So I opened the door, and I thought, if he really likes to be in with the cattle, he'd just walk in the barn. And he did. So I just closed the door. So I had this horse in my barn. So I thought, well, I can't put him in the work area, so I'll open the back door and let him in with the cows. Well, the horse just thought this was delightful. I mean, he just loved these cows, but my cows had never seen a horse. And I'd never seen my cows go through the barn so fast. And these are Angus cows. They're all pregnant about this wide. And if you see two cows heading for a door that's only this wide. I figured, I cannot do this with this horse. So I separated the cows on one side, put the horse on the other side, and went up to have supper. And that's where I'm going to leave it tonight. I want you to think about what you would do next. This story goes on for quite a while.